Today is Monday, June 7th, 2010. I'm Bradley Pepink, and this is News 101. Good evening and thanks for joining us. Today on the show, we bring you this week's edition of Groundwire, grassroots news from campus and community radio across the nation. From Groundwire this week, voices from CJSR Edmonton and CKDU Halifax will share stories from across Canada. Today, examining the upcoming G8 and G20 meetings, a controversial new bill appearing before the Yukon legislature, and toxic dumping in Nova Scotia. But before we go to Groundwire today, we'll jump to our weekly feature with Colleen Kimmett from the TAI. In this ongoing collaboration, Colleen joins us over the phone to chat about some recent stories published on the TAI.ca, the independent daily online magazine. And if you're a student in BC, stay tuned for today's chat. We'll be looking at a new program that could save the procrastinating academic much stress and upset. And lastly, we're proud to have this week's Arts Report with the very man himself. The Arts Director at CITR, Adam Janusz, joins us in studio to chat about what's happening in Vancouver. That's all on today's broadcast for June 7th here on News 101, your source for community and campus news and broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia in sunny Vancouver. But to start things off today, here are the latest headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Federal police in Mexico have forcibly removed strikers from a copper mine at the heart of a long-running labor dispute. Workers have occupied the Cananea copper mine for the past 3 years, calling for better on-the-job safety guarantees. The Cananea mine is Mexico's largest source of copper. The company that owns the mine, Grupo México, says it will renew operations with 2,000 contract workers. The National Miners Union has announced it will shut down one of Mexico's busiest ports and carry out a series of actions throughout the country. Two of Afghanistan's top security officials have resigned after failing to prevent Taliban attacks during last week's National Consultative Peace Jirga. Asma Namati has more from Kabul.
Minister of Interior Hanif Atmar and National Intelligence Chief Amrullah Saleh resigned Sunday in the wake of rocket attacks and a suicide bombing on the first day of the peace jirga. The National Consultative Peace Jirga was held last week to bring the Afghan civil war to end by means of reconciliation with the Taliban. The resignation stunned and worried people throughout Afghanistan and also surprised international diplomats and military officials. Both former officials worked closely with the U.S. and the leadership of the foreign military. Some analysts speculate the resignations came as a result of the security lapse, while others point to the long-standing disagreements between the two officials and President Karzai, most recently on the issue of releasing Taliban prisoners. The resignations come at a critical time for NATO's operation in Afghanistan. NATO is currently planning its biggest offensive in Kandahar since the beginning of the U.S.-led war. U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates called the resignations, quote, an internal matter and called on President Karzai to identify replacements of, quote, equal caliber. Asma Namadi, FSRN, Kabul.
A U.S. Army intelligence analyst alleged to have leaked footage of a deadly helicopter strike against civilians in Baghdad has been taken into custody by military investigators. The combat video made headlines in April after its release by the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. The 22-year-old analyst, specialist Bradley Manning, allegedly admitted to the leak during an instant messenger conversation with former hacker Adrian Lamo. Lamo told Wired.com that he handed over chat logs to Army investigators and to the FBI after Manning made statements about having released over a quarter million classified diplomatic cables. Amnesty International has released photos indicating cluster munitions were used in a U.S. airstrike that killed 55 people in Yemen last December. 21 children were among the dead. The stated target of the strike was an alleged al-Qaeda training camp. Philip Luther of Amnesty International called the attack, quote, grossly irresponsible. An international treaty to ban the use of cluster munitions will take effect in August, but the U.S. and Yemen are not signatories. Israeli naval forces killed four men in diver suits aboard a Palestinian boat near central Gaza's shores this morning. This as the three-year-long blockade of Gaza faces unprecedented international scrutiny. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
The Israeli Navy opened fire on a Palestinian boat this morning, killing four people aboard. The Israeli military alleges the men were planning to carry out a coastal attack against Israel. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, an armed offshoot of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah Party, has said the men were part of their group and were conducting a training exercise. The Israeli military also carried out an airstrike in northern Gaza today, saying it was to prevent the firing of a homemade rocket. The missile left one man seriously wounded. The three-year-old blockade of the Gaza Strip has come under severe international pressure in the wake of the deadly Israeli raid against an aid flotilla in international waters. Israel and Egypt sealed off border crossings with Gaza after Hamas's takeover of the coastal territory in June 2007. Egyptian authorities have opened the Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza, stating it will remain open until further notice. The Rafah terminal is the main outlet to the outside world for Gaza's 1.5 million residents. French and British officials have suggested that the European Union could take on a role of screening cargo arriving into Gaza's ports, as well as stepping up observation at the Rafah crossing terminal. Rami Almighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And finally, Hearst Newspapers has announced the retirement of veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas. This comes after the 89-year-old reporter made a controversial comment about Israel on video posted to the website rabbilive.com. Thomas was the longest-serving member of the White House press corps and held the coveted front and center seat in the press room. And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. We now turn to headlines from a more local source. The Taiyi's Colleen Kimmett joins me over the phone to talk about some of the most recently published articles from the Independent Online magazine. So first of all, thanks for joining us, Colleen.
You're welcome.
To start things off, oil and its significance continue to resonate across the globe. And last week we were talking about the impacts of what Canadians were feeling in terms of the spill in, off the Gulf Coast. And recently, the Taiyi published an article that highlights ongoing concerns expressed by British Columbians regarding the transportation of crude oil in British Columbia. So can you tell us a little bit about what this article is talking about in terms of the flow of oil, of crude oil, from the Alberta tar sands through British Columbia?
Sure. Mitchell Anderson reported last week how tanker traffic on the BC coast is quietly being scaled up with virtually no public engagement process, outdated regulations, and no federal oversight. The number of oil tankers already coming to BC coast are up nearly 50% in just 2 years. Now, this is coming out of a terminal in the Burrard Inlet, Westridge Terminal. Last year, about 3.9 million tons of Alberta crude oil was exported through this terminal, filling 65 oil tankers, so that's 20 more than in 2008. The pipeline is owned by Kinder Morgan, and it extends all the way from Haynes, Alberta, to North Burnaby. Its capacity is currently 300,000 barrels per day. That's almost 60% of the proposed volume of the Enbridge Northern Gateway pipeline in northern BC. And Kinder Morgan has plans to more than double that capacity to 700,000 barrels per day.
And so what does that mean for British Columbians? What is having all that traffic going through the province? How, what are the impacts of that?
Well, Anderson interviewed marine spill expert Stafford Reed, who believes that this increased oil tanker traffic could, in fact, be more dangerous than the very contentious pipeline project and port expansion that the Northern Gateway project would bring. He believes that oil spill risks increase not with the number of shipments rather than the size of tankers. And because the Burnaby Terminal and Burrard Inlet can't handle larger vessels, more oil means more tanker traffic.
Right, and so it's kind of, I guess, another one of those troubling issues in terms of getting, it's something that we obviously can't avoid, and so it's a matter of making sure that voices are being heard in terms of both sides of the debate. And I think that this article highlights a lot of the important issues going on in British Columbia. It's one of those issues that the TAI is always engaging with in terms of what's happening in Canada in terms of the energy sector. And one of the series that we have been focusing on that the TAI is really taking great strides on is the Clean Tech series. And we were talking last week about smart grids and a few weeks before that as well. And Andrew McLeod engaged recently in geothermal energy in this Clean Tech series. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about how geothermal fits into the Clean Tech series and how it compares to smart grids. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit about what geothermal systems are and why they're increasing in popularity.
Sure. Geothermal technology is also known as geoexchange. So wherever you live, the temperature a few meters below the surface of the ground remains the same year-round. And in winter, that heat that remains in the ground can be pulled up into a building. And in summer, the system can be reversed to cool the building by pumping heat back into the earth. So the system itself kind of works like a refrigerator with heat pumps and heat exchange technology and holes drilled down into the ground to either dump heat into the ground or pull heat up from the ground. And McLeod interviewed Barry Milner of Geotility, which is a well-established firm doing these kinds of systems in buildings. And he says for every unit of energy they use, they provide 4 to 5 units of heat. So that's incredible efficiency. And that means that we're reducing our carbon footprint because, you don't necessarily have to rely on a gas furnace if you have a system like this, and in improving air quality, decreasing our dependence on fossil fuels.
And so do you think that it could be safe to say that geothermal is especially important in British Columbia because you're able to kind of implement it into existing buildings because, we're a city with a lot of old buildings that are really not very successful in their carbon emissions. And so is that something that's kind of taking hold because of the infrastructure in British Columbia?
Well, I think that it's definitely a bonus. I mean, typically installing systems like this in an existing building is extremely cost prohibitive. The one project that Geotility is working on is the Hotel Georgia in downtown Vancouver that's been renovating anyway. And Geotility basically created kind of a small portable type of drilling platform that allowed them to retrofit the hotel with one of these systems. And I think Vancouver is especially ideal for geothermal or geoexchange because we do have a moderate climate. So it doesn't get really hot in the summer and it doesn't get really cold in the winter, which means theoretically a geoexchange system could completely cover your heating and cooling costs here, whereas in a colder climate or a hotter climate, you might need additional heating or air conditioning.
So jumping off from that really innovative project that really does affect a lot of Vancouverites, I want to jump to a story that affects really me personally and something I'm actually kind of really excited about. So I'm a student and I'm busy. In other words, that means that I'm prone to leave my essays to the last minute. I'm excited. Can you tell me a little bit about what's any hope for me out there? Like what can a new system that can help me procrastinate even more, I guess?
Yes. BC Books Online is an e-book collection that was released this May 12, 2010. This is a database, a digital collection of BC-published nonfiction books. It's a one-of-a-kind database. It's got a copy and paste function. It allows readers to download portions of books. It's got digital volumes that can be highlighted on screen, bookmarked, and printed. It means that if you are, doing a last-minute rush to finish that essay, it's late, the library's closed, you can still find the book you need online. And it's the result of an effort by a consortium of organizations and publishers. It's been 3 years in the making. And it's really kind of exciting, I think. It's focusing on BC history, Aboriginal culture, political commentary, arts and culture, biography, autobiography, the environment, and urban issues.
And so I think one of the highlights for me, one of the things that I really took out of it was that more than one person is able to sort of say download or take out one of these books at a time, whereas the BC library system the Vancouver Public Library, to my understanding, only one person can have that electronic version at a time. Do you think that this is something that more libraries will move towards in the future and having more ebooks?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. And I think publishers are recognizing this. They're beginning to revisit their contracts with authors to acquire electronic rights so that if that book does, if it could be collected, it could be more easily collected in an e-book collection. So I think it's something that, libraries are recognizing, publishers are recognizing. I was reading an article about a big booksellers fair in New York City, and the author was saying that e-books were high on the agenda there.
And obviously very important in terms of those who are following the new iPhone, because the new iPhone 4 will have the iBook capability where they connect instantly to that that whole system. But speaking about publishing and a matter of getting stories out there, we really do love having this partnership with the TAI, but maybe you could tell us a little bit about how the TAI is operating and what's going on right now.
Yeah, well, we're about halfway through a fundraising drive for the TAI Reporting Fellowship Funds. So these fellowships are focused on investigative and solutions-oriented journalism. We give out four fellowships a year worth $5,000. And I can tell you as a journalist, I mean, to be given a chunk of money to basically fund a good chunk of time to really dig into a subject is so important. And, we've funded a series in the past that have been quite groundbreaking. Chris Wood did an investigative series on how global warming will hit BC. We published a really popular solution series by writer Dave Olson on basically making the argument for free public transit. So, yeah, we're about halfway through this funding drive. We're looking to raise $10,000, and anything you can contribute, $5, $10, $20, it's very much welcome. So you can find more information on the TAI.ca.
Well, thanks so much again, Colleen, for speaking with us. We really do appreciate having these collaborations. And I do urge our listeners to be able to go out to the TAI.ca to check out what's happening there and maybe catch some of these stories and learn more about what's going on. Again, thanks, Colleen, for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Colleen Kimmett from the TAI.ca. And for more on these stories and to check out that fun drive, check out the TAI.ca. That's TheTyee.ca. We're going to take a quick break, but in 2 minutes and 30 seconds, we will hear from Arts Director Adam Janusz about what's happening in the arts in Vancouver. That's next here on News 101, your home for local, national, and international news on the community radio station CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Big government and big pharma have entered into a secret conspiracy, in which secret government contracts are sold to Big Pharma that allow for secret chemicals to be placed in coffee seeds, all under the watchful eye of Big Coffee, who is secretly working with other world forces, all in a sinister plot to get alien embryos in our coffee so Big Pharma can sell us alien contraceptive pills. Or, if you'd rather get some rational news, check out Radio Free Thinker, the radio show / podcast that promotes skepticism, critical thinking, and science education. Every Tuesdays at 4 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
North by Northeast is back, taking over Toronto June 14th to June 20th. 7 days and nights, 50 venues, 650 bands from 25 countries and dozens of genres. These bands have just been announced. Iggy and the Stooges.
I am a passenger.
The Ravenettes. De La Soul,
Potholes in My Love,
Mudhoney,
Here Comes Sickness, Here Comes,
Les Savis Fab,
7 seconds, he'd be dead,
Sloan, and hundreds more. Plus 40 of the year's best music-related films. All of this for just $50. Wristbands are on sale in stores and online. Check out www.nxne.com for tickets and full festival info. North by Northeast, when music takes over.
What does it all mean?
Difficult preaching is posthumous pleasure. Pleasure in preaching starts in the heart.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. You're either hearing us live, broadcasting from the Student Union Building at 101.9 on the FM dial and streaming online from your speakers at CITR.ca, or from the future via our podcasts available online at CITR.ca. And I'm just realizing that you may be able to hear the fan in studio because it is hot in here. And so I apologize. The background noise is a fan trying to cool us down. So I am joined now in studio with the arts director here at CITR, Mr. Adam Janusz, who's here to chat about what's happening in the local arts scene. So Adam,
Hello.
What's happening?
First of all, let me apologize for the fan. I am a bit of a prima donna, and I just need air. But yeah, thanks
for having
me.
It's looking good, though. Your hair's flowing really nicely. It's picturesque.
It's very dreamlike, if you could see it only. I have a arts event to tell you about, and that is a couple of artists, James Kirkpatrick and Jamie Q of the art duo known as Dusty Peas, are in Vancouver to do an exhibition. And on Saturday, June the 5th, they had an opening party and a book launch. And but the show goes on until the 13th, and on Thursday, they were featured on a show here at CITR called Ink Studs, I believe. Did I get that right? Yes, that's right. Ink Studs with Robin McConnell. And so I thought I'd play you a piece of the interview that Robin had with James and Jamie. The only thing is you'll have to give me a minute as I pull it up.
All right. Well, no, that's good. I'm excited to hear what's happening with these artists.
Yeah. As am I. Now, for some reason, it's not coming up.
We should apologize. Last week, we were having when we were speaking with Colleen, Kimmett from the TAI, our phone system wasn't working, and we had to take a little break while we kind of rebooted that. And just for everyone who's listening, we are moving on to a new operating system here at CITR in the studio. We've had a new program designed for our radio station, and so we're transferring all our files over to it, and it's taking a little bit of a process. It's a little tedious trying to learn a new system, as everyone knows, but hopefully it'll help us out in the long run.
Why don't we take a quick break and find this clip?
All right. Well, when we come back, we'll have more of this week's arts report from Adam Janusz. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Turf Music and Dedication Entertainment are proud to present Move the Mountains Tour, Saturday, June 19th at 917 Main Street. This West Canadian hip-hop tour is focused on bringing the best in underground hip-hop and will have its final night here in Vancouver. On the tour are Dragonfly Empire, Fallen Soldier, Justin Brave, and The Groundbreakers. Be one of the first 50 people through the door and receive free album downloads. Move the Mountains Tour. Doors open at 9. Saturday, June 19th, 917 Main Street. Tickets available at Beat Street, Zulu, Van City Skateboards, and online at www.clubzone.com.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada. You're listening to CITR 101.9.
CITR 101.9 FM presents the Girlfriends and Boyfriends CD Release Party, also featuring Sex with Strangers, Muscles, and Girls in Love on Saturday, June 12th at the Media Club, 696 Canby Street. Doors are at 8 and the show begins at 9:30.
Not for me. With my head in the clouds, and I'm a waiting for the moment.
Girlfriends and Boyfriends CD release party, also featuring Sex with Strangers, Muscles, and Girls in Love. Saturday, June 12th at the Media Club. Tickets are available online at themediaclub.ca.
CITR loves its friends. Having a Friends of CITR card entitles you to awesome discounts from businesses in your community. Maybe downtown is your stomping ground. Present your CITR card at 212 Productions Limited, Beat Street Records, Woo Vintage Clothing, Hits Boutique, Dream Apparel and Articles for People, Scratch Records, The Fall Tattooing, Flaming Angel Designs, Spank Clothing, Heart and Soul, Pacific Cinema Tech, and True Value Vintage, and receive great discounts. So become a CITR member, get a free Friends card, and feel the love.
I wanna love you and treat you right. I wanna love you.
You're back with Brad Pepink and Adam Janusz here at CITR 101.9, the news and arts directors. And Adam, we had a little bit of technical difficulties, but let's jump back to that clip you're chatting about.
Yes, apologies for that, but we now have the clip of Dusty Pease on Inkstuds with Robin McConnell. And the clip that you will hear is James and Jamie talking about how they collaborate and what the collaboration is what the exhibition is all about. So they'll talk about that. And you'll also hear how felt markers come up and how they contribute to their inspiration. So here goes.
But I'm presuming there's going to be more than just the two books at the art show.
Yeah, it's also a show of paintings.
Of paintings. Yeah. Now, the paintings are collaborations all between the two of you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's there's right. 26 new paintings. And we had it even on a timer. Like, most of them were 10-minute. There's a few that were 5-minute. Sessions, but it was like 10 minutes and then we'd switch them and then another 10 minutes and then we'd switch them
and like pass them back and forth every 10
like chess.
Yeah, so we're working on like two paintings at the same time.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you guys start collaborating? Is it kind of coming from that scene we were mentioning, or?
Well, I mean, I've been doing collaborative work with a bunch of people before. Jamie's done some collaborative work with a bunch of people before, so when we like started becoming friends and stuff through Peter Thompson, actually, we just naturally started collaborating together and it just it clicked, you know.
These are, our zine Party in the Middle collects a lot of our earliest ones that were marker sort of doodly marker drawings.
It's what kind of markers, because like their markers kind of undersells it, because you
these
can get some nice
markers. Do you know what
those were markers I've had since I was a kid.
Oh, so like total Crayola style.
Yeah, nice. Like they don't even have a name on the side. Like they're like, you know, real cheap ones that, you know, I acquired somehow as a kid.
I think they're just white and they have a colored lid, right?
Some of them had the color on. Oh, yeah. Those were the white ones with colored lid. Yeah. So those are straight up, the same markers. I actually, because I've always kind of used markers, you know, here and there, but a lot more lately now, and especially because I brought them back for our drawings together and stuff.
How did the...
All right, and that was James Kirkpatrick and Jamie Q of Dusty Pease, and their show is still on until the 13th, and that's at Lucky's Comics at 3972 Main Street in Vancouver. That's all for this segment of the Arts Report. Join me on Wednesday at 5 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM for our weekly arts report, an hour of arts goodness.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Adam. I do apologize to our listeners that had to cut this one short, but we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll have this week's edition of Groundwire, addressing local, provincial, national, and international issues. Make sure you stay tuned, because this week's report highlights toxic dumping, controversial new legislation, and ongoing coverage in lead up to the G8 and G20 meetings. That's here in only a few seconds.
Yeah, all we need is some funky dev chow.
Feeling funky.
1, 2, party people in the place to be.
Funky dope. Funky dope.
1, 2, party people in the place
Rainbow
to be.
Rainbow Groove here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Every Friday night from 9 to 10:30 p.m. Getting you in the mood for the weekend. I'm your host, DJ BFAT, and I'll present a kaleidoscope of funky grooves for your mind, body, and soul. Tune in to hear everything from underground disco, roller boogie, space funk, rare groove, jazzy house, dub reggae, and anything and everything from Chaka Khan to The Clash. That's Rainbow Groove every Friday night from 9 to 10:30 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Crazy fresh, crazy fresh.
Yeah, all we need is some-
Welcome back to News 101, broadcasting at CITR 101.9 FM live in Vancouver. We're going to jump now to Groundwire, which is a grassroots radio program produced by the NCRA, which is the National Campus and Community Radio Association, featuring voices from across the country. And today, Groundwire was produced by the lovely folks at CJSR in Edmonton and CKDU in Halifax. So without any further ado, here's Groundwire.
UBC Rec is everything that is recreation on campus. No matter how you play, UBC Rec is your resource for fun activities. This student program is operated by over 140 volunteers, and it is the largest intramural recreation organization in Canada. Programs cover fitness, instructional classes, outdoor recreation, drop-in sports, special events, small tournaments, and intramural leagues. All the registration information is available in the Student Recreation Center or online at rec.ubc.ca. UBC Rec, how do you play?
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
You are listening to Groundwire, grassroots news coverage from coast to coast to coast. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association. This week on Groundwire.
Every bit of green in our neighborhood makes a difference.
The whole plan was to displace these people by force.
And academia needs to ask these questions.
Plus, community reports from Radio Free Palestine, as well as the first annual regional community radio conference in Nelson, BC. But first, the headlines. A new common front for housing rights in Nova Scotia says housing is one of the most pressing issues facing poor and working people in the province. In recent community forums, activists, social workers, and community members have been building on the momentum created by the Out of the Cold Emergency Shelter to work together on common principles, including the universal right to quality, affordable housing. According to the Halifax Report Card on Homelessness, 1,718 people were homeless and stayed in a shelter in 2009. The report also shows that income assistance rent allowance for a single person with a disability is $535, while average rent for a bachelor apartment is $638. Cole Weber is an organizer with the Common Front and a social worker at Dalhousie Legal Aid.
We face a housing crisis in Nova Scotia, both in terms of affordability and quality of housing. Homelessness is increasing. Thousands of people live in substandard housing. Thousands of people across the province pay exorbitant prices and disproportionate amounts of their income for their housing. So that's why it's important that a housing coalition form.
The Out of Cold Emergency Shelter opened in 2008 as a direct community-led response to the closure of Pendleton Place, Halifax's only shelter of last resort. Staffed entirely by volunteers, the shelter operated out of St. Matthew's United Church from November to April. 7 days a week, providing 15 beds each night. The first association to make an academic discipline out of mothering has closed its doors. The Association for Research on Mothering, ARM, was housed by York University for the past 12 years until its closure in March. The center did not receive any York funding. Though the association published a popular research journal, hosted numerous conferences, and supported a feminist press, it had to raise its own funds through member fees, press sales, and grants from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council. ARM also co-founded the International Mothers Network, now with 120 members worldwide, and co-founded the Museum of Motherhood. ARM supporters are left puzzled as to why ARM was shut out of even small-scale funding year after year. York University, for its part, alleges financial irregularities led to the decision to close the association. Groundwire filed an access to information request, but a recent gag order has prevented full disclosure. One of ARM's most recent projects was a large-scale research study called Mothering in the Academy, which looked at barriers mothers face in academia. Pat Breton is a York PhD candidate whose research also centers on mothering identity. Pat was dismayed at ARM's closure and advocates more support for feminist scholarship.
I have to say, I was quite disappointed to see that ARM was cut. Mothering, it's certainly not kind of a primary area of research. I think that's part of the problem. So how come women and children in Canada are the poorest, right? What is that about? It's totally reflective of the larger society and how we value mothers, the work of mothering, and academia needs to ask these questions.
Down but not out, in May, ARM members launched the new Mothering Initiative for Research and Community Involvement with a literary gala on May 21st. See motherhoodinstitute.org. Some students, staff, and faculty at Mount Allison University do not want Indigo founder and CEO Heather Reisman to receive an honorary degree during the May 17th convocation ceremony because of her direct connection to the Israeli military. In 2005, Reisman and her husband Gerald Schwartz founded the Hesig Foundation, an organization that provides full academic scholarships and living expenses to former lone soldiers who have completed the service in the Israel Defense Forces and have chosen to make Israel their home. The university received emails from across the country, both in opposition and in support of Reisman. Several professors at the university also signed an online petition against the degree conferral. Though the attempts to have the decision reversed failed, and Reisman did receive the honorary degree, it has spurred a process of community engagement at the university, and many are now calling for a revision in how honorary degrees are awarded. May 17th was International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. Trans community activists and organizations gathered at Queen's Park in Toronto to support amending the Ontario Human Rights Code to include gender identity. The amended bill, or Toby's Act, would include gender identity as a prohibited ground of discrimination. While the Ontario Human Rights Commission recommended the inclusion of the gender identity in the code in year 2000, this is the third time NDP MPP Cherry DeNovo has brought forth the act. According to Susan Gapka, chair of the Trans Health Lobby Group, the delay in government response can be attributed to the lack of organizational support in the early 2000s, and the proroguing of the provincial government twice, forcing the reintroduction of the bill several times.
Telling people we have an idea or there's something we want is one thing, it's a concept. But when we have a bill, it's much more tangible. But it also would say a clear, strong message to landlords, employers, people who provide services, that it's wrong to discriminate.
Gapka says the amendment to the Ontario Human Rights Code would serve as a legislative protection from the discrimination that trans people often face. Meanwhile, a similar bill has been introduced to Parliament on May 10th, calling for the inclusion of gender identity and gender expression to the Canadian Human Rights Act. Gender identity is currently included on explicit grounds for human rights protection in the Northwest Territories, in several U.S. states, and in United Kingdom legislation. Feature stories. From Montreal, Annick Babinski reports on Parc Oxygène. Created 20 years ago when residents took it upon themselves to convert a dangerous downtown Montreal alley into a green space, the years of success are now threatened. Norman Navrosky, a member of Montreal's Milton Park project, is raising awareness about a recent zoning change which will allow developers to build on the privately owned site.
20 years ago, residents of the Milton Park neighborhood in downtown Montreal took action for the safety and well-being of their community. After years of finding no municipal response to their requests to make a busy back alleyway safer for local pedestrians, residents dug up either side of the lane, brought in soil and trees, and named it Parc Oxygène. Since that day, the park, although privately owned, has been maintained on a volunteer basis by members of the Milton Park Project. It serves as a dog walking and social lunching area for all the well-established local residents, the people who work in the surrounding office towers, and the transient student population from nearby McGill University. All of this could soon change. Due to a recent rezoning of the site, Parc Oxygène's existence is now threatened by land developers eager to build over the greenery. Chris Betts caught up with Norman Narwaki, a member of the Milton Park Project. He's organizing the Summer Lovin' Festival, which will take place in Parc Oxygène every second Sunday this summer.
Come together with us in this park and let's keep this park green and let's keep this space our neighborhood space. So we're trying to raise the profile of the park and we're trying to let the city know that this many people support keeping Parc Oxygène and we want you to do something about that. So now we would like the current administration to take charge of the matter and to rectify the mistake that was made in the past, because the current administration is definitely pushing a green agenda. And as you said, our park has been green for 20 years. It's, you know, all citizen volunteer work that's kept it that way. So why can't you now come to our help and, you know, do something about it and legally right that wrong with the zoning change? We're just hoping that, considering the context today when the city of Montreal is talking more than ever about keeping Montreal green, making Montreal green, that Parc Oxygène is part of that plan. It's got to be. It's got to be. And the more green spaces like Parc Oxygène we have, the healthier this city will be. It's so obvious.
Vicky Tobayana, reporter for the McGill Daily, captured the city's response to the demands of those involved in the Milton Park project with a quotation from City Councillor Michelle Prescott. Prescott argued that the city does not have the budget to purchase the land, and that if they did, the city would be hesitant to set such a precedent. Quote, "We cannot buy all the small lands in Montreal and create parks, and if we do it for this park, then we will be asked to do the same thing for other areas, and we cannot afford that," said Prescott.
You can't really put a price tag on, as you said, a calm space in the middle of the city. We live in one of the densest neighborhoods in Montreal, with the La Cité high-rises all around us, and all the traffic that pours into the city coming down Park Avenue. It's one of the busiest streets in terms of delivering cars and moving people into the city core. Well, we suffer the pollution from all that. So every bit of green in our neighborhood makes a difference. And it's like, yeah, we need this to live.
The Summer Lovin' Festival in Parc Oxygène is occurring every second Sunday between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. from May 16th until August 8th. Music, theater, art, dance, and more are on the agenda. If you are interested in learning more about the rich history of struggle against gentrification in Montreal's Milton Park neighborhood, visit miltonpark.org on the internet. I'm Anique Adi-Babinski, reporting from Montreal for Groundwire.
Welcome back. Mining companies are increasing their threats towards activists, academics, and writers. In addition to the deaths of activists at mines in El Salvador and Philippines this spring, mining giant Barrick Gold is maneuvering to muzzle any scholarship about its global holdings and environmental standards. A book that investigates the economic motivations that bring over 70% of the world's mining business to Canadian soil has been pulled from print due to threats of legal action by Barrick Gold. Amidst these unsettling conditions, community organizers and representatives from affected communities converged at this year's Mining Injustice Conference in Toronto. CHRY Radio's Annabelle Kuhn was there.
Mining Injustice, the second annual anti-mining conference, featured speakers from Latin America to Africa, to Papua New Guinea, to First Nations within Canada. Together they shared successes, challenges, and strategies for environmental and social justice in the extractive industries, 75% of which are based out of Canada. Indigenous leaders from Papua New Guinea spoke on the destruction of the Porgera mine, owned by Toronto-based Barrick Gold. Indigenous communities in the Porgera Valley have had to face the environmental devastation of their land, forced displacement, and the burning of their homes on three separate occasions. In the lead-up to these actions, Porgera MP Philip Kikala established a state of emergency in an effort to restore peace in Pagra. However, according to Amnesty International, there is substantial evidence that the police acted contrary to their search warrants, and none of the safeguards required under international law were implemented. As a result of an international outcry, the community was able to get a restraining order on the government and Barrick Gold. Jethro Tulin, a leader in opposing the Pagra mine, explains.
But somehow we got the attention of the international NGO communities, and we actually had a court order, which is still pending now, restraining them from any further action. So those are the things that have stopped the illegal behavior. Otherwise, the whole plan was to displace these people by force. Not on a sustainable way, as they say it out in their books or in the media.
The conference took place as Bill C-300 is being considered in the House of Commons. Bill C-300 is the Corporate Accountability of Mining, Oil, and Gas Corporations in Developing Countries Act. The act would deny Canadian public investments to Canadian corporations found to be abusing human rights overseas. However, communities in Canada and Turtle Island, where those very companies are based, are still lacking in such protections. Clifton Nicholas, a Mohawk community activist, spoke about a proposed mine in Gonesatake and Oka, Quebec. The local native community is still dealing with the repercussions of the historic Oka crisis 20 years later. Meanwhile, Niocan, a Montreal-based mining company, is seeking to mine niobium, a mineral used in the military-industrial complex to lighten and harden steel.
Now you see, like, this isn't coincidental, you know, it deliberate in the series of maneuverings on the part of the government and the neglect in the community. So what this mining project intends on doing is to destroy the water table. And they're clear about it. We have to, the water table will be contaminated because we need water to mine this mineral. And there'll be all kinds of toxic tailings that'll be attached to their mining operation.
5 years ago, an environmental assessment report by the Bureau d'audience publique sur l'environnement advised the Quebec government that the uncertain character of the mine water and its flow weakens, quote, any assessment of their effects. The report also noted that most consultation participants are, quote, very concerned about the mining project to which they did not consent, end quote. Clifton Nicholas explains the complex challenges that residents of Gonesatake currently face in opposing the Niocan mine.
It's quite interesting right now because we're at a juncture where the non-native farmers and then the people of Gonesatake are able to unify and come together to combat this company. There's a lot of farmers that don't want it to happen because it'll destroy their livelihood, it'll destroy their farms. So we have a lot of power behind that because it's at the stage now where they're on the cusp of getting it done. However, these non-native farmers are blocking it because they refuse to sell. But doesn't mean all of them, because there's some of them that say, well, if the price is right, I might sell. That's the glaring difference between the non-native population and the native population.
A major focus of the conference was on building support among participants for a stronger anti-mining movement globally. Activist Susanna Duranger of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation emphasized the importance of solidarity in speaking about the resistance movement in the Peruvian Amazon.
And it's interesting what's happening there. They can't divide the people in their stand for no against the mines. And the river downstream from them, more and more people are starting to say we need to work because they were massacred on June 5th last year, and there's a lot of post-traumatic stress and nobody in there doing any kind of healing. And with that post-traumatic stress, people are feeling like giving up and giving everything away. And so we need to defend them. We need to come together and make one solid alliance, north, south, and for the whole world.
For more information on anti-mining resistance movements, please visit solidarityresponse.net. For GrandWire, I'm Annabelle Koo, reporting from CHRY in Toronto.
On May 13th, seven community radio stations across North America joined the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem to broadcast Radio Free Palestine, a historic radio reflection of the Palestine Nakba, or catastrophe. Here are some highlights of the international radio collaboration.
Remember what happened in 1948. This is Radio Free Palestine, broadcasting on 62 years of dispossession and resistance. In 1948, 85% of the Palestinians living in the areas that became the State of Israel became refugees. More than 500 Palestinian villages were depopulated and later destroyed to prevent the return of the refugees. Today, there are over 7 million Palestinian refugees dispersed throughout the world, the largest and longest-running refugee problem yet unsolved. 62 years later, Israel continues to occupy and colonize Palestinian land through the construction of Jewish-only settlements and the wall in Jerusalem and the West Bank.
In Bethlehem, the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements, as well as a number of organizations and activists, are planning a rally in the village of Al-Masara, where Israel is expanding part of the annexation wall. Mahmoud Zawahra, a member of the Popular Committee in Al-Masara village.
Popular culture means popular resistance, where the people tomorrow want to remember. We are going to connect building the wall with the Nakba that happened to the Palestinians in 1948.
Palestinians in Haifa have decided to commemorate the Nakba by touring around the city with youth, explaining to them the history of the Nakba. Rabi Agbariya, a 17-year-old youth from Haifa, and one of the organizers of the activity.
In Haifa, we're planning to go through the old city and speak about the historical past of Haifa, the way the Palestinian people in the Nakba in 48, the Israel forces turned them to refugees, and we're hoping that many students and teenagers will learn more about the historical past of Haifa.
Welcome back. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. That was Groundwire, grassroots news from across the nation. And that marks the end of our show for June 7th, 2010. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. And if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with your username, CITR News, and you can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. Adam Yanush produced this radio program, and please join us on Monday, this coming Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Again, I'm Brad Pepink, and from the entire news team at CITR, thanks so much for listening. At 6 o'clock, stay tuned for Career Fast Track, which is, again, at CITR 101.9 FM. I'm going to leave you with a few songs from the band Apollo Ghosts, who are taking part in the Music Waste Festival that's happening in the city of Vancouver right now. We're going to jump to a little bit of a public service announcement before that, but again, stay tuned for Phil's show, Career Fast Track, at 6 o'clock, and thanks so much for listening to the news.
I'm from Tawfiq Zayadi, the late Palestinian poet, mayor of
Perf Music
Nazareth.
And Dedication Thank Entertainment you, are proud to present Move the Mountains Tour, Saturday, June 19th at 917 Main Street. This West Canadian hip-hop tour is focused on bringing the best in underground hip-hop and will have its final night here in Vancouver. On the tour are Dragonfly Empire, Fallen Soldier, Justin Brave, and The Groundbreakers. Be one of the first 50 people through the door and receive free album downloads. Move the Mountains Tour. Doors open at 9. Saturday, June 19th, 917 Main Street. Tickets available at Beat Street, Zulu, Van City Skateboards, and online at www.clubzone.com.
Music Waste 2010 ad pitches.
Hello, and your name is?
My name is Johnny Rockstar.
And your previous ad campaigns?
So I've done ad campaigns for Mountain Drew Energy Drinks, Red Bull, and Rockstar.
Okay, let's see what you got.
Music Waste 2010, June 2nd and 5th.
Music, art, and comedy!
MusicWaste.ca.
Sorry, there will be no monster trucks.
Get out.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support Music Waste.
Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.